I'm Louise Steinman, curator of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. You're about to hear Judith Thurman, the author of a book of essays called Cleopatra's Nose, 39 Varieties of Desire. In conversation with Thurman is Gail Eichenthal, Director of Arts Programming, Classical KUSC 91.5. Judith Thurman is a longtime New Yorker writer and biographer of Colette and Isaac Dinesen. She once spent an evening with Jackie Onassis, smoking cigarettes and talking about men. In this new book, she calls from 20 years of probing and delightful critiques of all aspects of culture. This program was originally produced on Wednesday, November 28, 2007. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org.
It's delightful to see all of you here. This is my first time as the interviewer, or co-conversationalist, I should say. I'm usually out there with you, so this is a great thrill for me. Talk about a thrill. This book, when you finish reading it, you feel like you've had several college degrees in one. It's fantastically entertaining and fantastically illuminating about the human condition. And so we're going to talk about how you make that happen in your prose. And one thing that really struck me in the introduction to the book was you're saying that in a way, when you finish reading 39 pieces by a journalist, you've read a biography of the journalist, making no bones right in the introduction of the book that this is also about you. And maybe you could talk about your ease with which you recognize that. Has that always been true as a writer of nonfiction?
I think you struggle as a nonfiction subject to suppress yourself in a way. I mean, as a biographer, biography is a biographer is in a way a handmaiden, and you serve your subject. You devote years of your life to the subject's life. I do not know what I did last week. I can tell you what Colette was doing on November 28th, 1924, 36, 51. So it's a strange kind of abnegation, and the self sort of cries for existence too, and there's a back and forth. You have to be very careful of that also, because it can become about that. It can become your duel with the subject, and it really isn't. I often find that I start these pieces with a little riff, a personal riff. It's the way that I get into it. It's the way that I sort of satisfy the little cry, me too, and then get it over with, and also connect with the subject, and sort of feel my way into it. It's like those boats, the launching, those little metal things that you slide a boat into a lake with is a personal story. I did that in the Saint Laurent piece. I couldn't find a beginning, and then I remembered that as a very young woman, I had spent an entire week's salary on a Saint Laurent skirt that was on sale in the Bond Street shop in 1969.
And in the Chanel piece, you talk about a close brush with a couture opalescent pink suit that you describe with such loving affection that I wondered why. How did you resist it?
No, it's especially true in the fashion pieces, because it's such a visceral connection to these clothing, to the clothing that you have sort of coveted and admired. And the Chanel suit, you know what's wrong with it? I almost bought it, even though it was a ridiculous amount of money. The jacket was just too short. The Chanel... Mid-century Chanel is, in fact, rather dowdy unless you wear it with a kind of subversive idea.
I think you were polite enough not to mention that in the piece. The word dowdy is not in the piece. Was there a time when you were a younger writer that you thought it was appropriate to leave yourself out more than you do now? Are you more at peace with that?
I actually find myself more at ease with leaving myself out now. I think as when I was younger, it was sort of the hand in the front row, you know, call on me. And I'm sort of, in a way, I've done enough of that, it seems to me. It's a very strange experience with this book, because with the two biographies of Isaac Dinesen and Colette, The reviews were about them, and the pictures were their pictures. And for the first time, there I am. There's my picture staring up from the book review. It's a bit odd. I haven't quite gotten used to that.
Very pretty picture. What nonfiction writers were you inspired by or influenced by?
Well, Leonie Dell taught me to write biographies. I started my first biography, I was, 25 or 26, and I was a poet, and I'd never written anything much longer than 13 lines. And I thought that, books have chapters, and that's the unit of composition, it's a chapter. And it's very hard to write a chapter, especially of a biography, in which, is it a year, is it 5 years, is it... And I was just finding it really, really, really difficult to put a chapter together. And then reading Leonie Dell's wonderful four-volume biography of Henry James, which you really hope will never end. It's such a readable narrative. Adele breaks down the facts. He organizes the book in tiny little short sections, and he even gives himself the luxury of numbering them. I always number the sections so that I'm sort of accumulating text as I go along, and then I take out the numbers. But he left them in, and they were each maybe 300, 400, 500 words, and then he could move them around. Like, remember those pop beads that you know, most of you don't, but there's pop beads. You could move them around and put together, string them together into, and then that liberated me. So he was a great model for biography. Walter Benjamin is my hero as an essayist. Especially Illuminations, and especially the essay in Illuminations on Leskov, Nikolai Leskov, the storyteller. Benjamin is one of those writers who just gives. His sentences just are radiant with generosity, intellectual generosity, and emotional generosity, and the prose is so extraordinary. And I go to that book when I'm feeling really down, and it's sort of like... It's an incredible stimulant. There are many others, but I think for what I do, they're my models.
There's certainly a tremendous amount of poetry in your prose, but it strikes me that that's such a very different form of writing, because poetry is so concise and concentrated, and a biography, you know, almost by definition has to be comprehensive, otherwise it's not a good biography. How have you sort of juggled those two selves in you, the poet and the hyper-focused biographer?
Well, you have to, in especially writing for The New Yorker, to some degree, you have to suppress the lyrical impulse. and if I don't suppress it, my editors do. What I learned from poetry, or what sort of I internalized as a poet, is the notion of metaphor, which is the association of incongruous images, of incongruous ideas, and that, I think, works marvelously well in small quantities in the work of in an essay. It was pointed out to me, actually, also by Catherine Harrison, that in writing about bulimia, I talked about it as a form of Maoism, and I wasn't a utopian moral extremism. Driven by perfectionism and notion of perfectibility. I didn't think of it as a poetic image, but that's what you get out of poetry, the complication of a metaphor without without making a simile, an equation. It's an association. That's very helpful. But poetry is actually, it's hard to get over that kind of compression. I find it hard to write at great length. Whenever I set out to write a 5,000-word piece, I think, oh, my God. I keep the word count on the computer all the time. 400 words, 900 words. Oh, getting close. Only 1,200 more words. So there's that also. There's the sense of having to expand that I find unnatural.
I once had the great fortune of interviewing the novelist Carol Shields, and she talked a little bit about her creative process. And she made it almost in terms of a math formula that she writes 2 pages a day, and then in 6 months, voila, you have a novel. And I'm not doing the math in my head right now, but I then was reading a novel of hers maybe 6 months later or something like that, and I finished it, and I realized with almost a chill that the math added up perfectly. It was exactly the amount of pages that if she had written 2 pages a day in 6 months, she would have a novel. Do you work that diligently? That do you have a mandate of 2 pages a day, or how do you do that?
No, I work in in psychotic bursts. I work on deadline. I seem to need the terror of a deadline to make me work. And of course, for the biographies, it was 7 years of that. But I spent a lot of the 7 years sort of staring into space. I seem to need the extreme pressure to mobilize myself. I have friends who work like that. In fact, I once met my colleague at The New Yorker, Louis Menand, who's known as Luke. It was on a Friday night, and we met at a dinner party in Manhattan. And I said, oh, what are you working on? He said, oh, I'm wrapping up a rather long piece on metaphysicals, and with some other things thrown in, the history of New England and the, I don't know, Wittgenstein or something.
The Beatles, probably.
The Beatles, too. I don't know. Yeah. And I said, oh, well, when is it due? He said, Monday. Choked. I said, what do you mean Monday? Why are you here? He said, well, I have the whole weekend. I said, well, how do you write then? I don't understand this. So I would be suicidal, and I would hope that it would pass. But he said, I'm a bricklayer. I write one line at a time, one brick at a time, and then the mortar, and then I smooth it off. When I have a beautiful row, I go on to the next row. And I just work in a sort of anarchic, unlinear way, hoping that I will find the sentence that will show me the way out of the dark wood. And in fact, until I find that sentence, I'm in the dark wood, feeling very lost, and increasingly lost, increasingly disoriented, as you are when you're searching for the way out and you don't find it. So
then there does a light go on and the forest lights up and you know you have a way out?
No, and every time, I'm never sure that I'm going to find it. There's another story. The piece in this book on it was a show at the Met on extreme fashion, all of the sort of the foot binding and bustles and corsets and all of these things. It was a wonderful show. I had 3 days to write it, and I was desperate. I couldn't find the first line that unlocked the show for me. And I called my editor and I said, I'm going to have to quit this magazine. I'm not up to it. I can't write like this. And she said, just take a deep breath and take a nice bath, a hot bath. Forget about it. I'm going to go to David and I'm going to get you another 3 or 4 days. You'll be fine. So I was relieved and I drew a bath and I lay in the bath and the tension began to release and I found a way to start it. I talk about salmon in the Thames in the 17th century. Okay.
There's the water connection between the bath and the river, of course.
Jumped out of the bath, rushed upstairs, called Sharon and said, I think I have a beginning. She said, great, I was never getting you more time.
Ouch. Oh, my God. What is the interaction with editors at The New Yorker, which is, you know, almost mythical to those of us who read the magazine? How many editors read your pieces?
Well, you have a very intimate relationship with your editor. It's sort of like a tutor and a student at Oxford, not that I ever went there, but that's what I'm told. Your editor runs interference for you. She keeps track of the assignments and how many words you owe, and she will sort of start getting nervous if you're running behind. But every piece at The New Yorker is read, and there are 6 sets of proofs, and 6 different people read them, make comments on them, and the copy editor, your editor, the managing editor, David Remnick, the editor-in-chief, the proofreader. And they all have to be synthesized, and you have to answer the comments, and some of them are conflictual. Some people like one thing, other.
I would think so.
And your editor will decide what it is. She has the authority to say, no, David, we're not going to pay attention to that, or we're not going to change this to a semicolon. So that's also part of it. But your editor really will send, my editor, Virginia Cannon, who's wonderful, very astute reader, she often sends me back for 3 or 4 rewrites. She wants me to change the balance of the piece. The end is too heavy, the beginning is too light, the middle is whatever. There's a lot of editing. And it's very painful because when you turn it in, you feel it's pretty polished. So you need the stamina for a lot of rewriting and a kind of humility.
You told me a story earlier today that once you discovered that the editor was right after all, something you had fought like crazy to keep in.
Well, Virginia is a minimalist, and I'm sort of not. There's always this kind of, I have to repress the Jamesian flourish and the sentence that goes on for a paragraph. And it was a piece, the tofu piece, and it's quite an austere piece. And Virginia tends to, well, many writers have this experience. The sentence you love the best has to go. There's a reason that you're so attached to it. And it often is not communicating the passion to the reader. So she wanted to cut a sentence that I was desperately in love with. And finally I gave in. And when I came to anthologize it, I thought, I'm going to put that sentence back. And I went and I looked back at the first draft, which was on my desk of the computer, and I thought, I realized she was right. With the little distance, having let go of the sentence, it needed to be banished.
Wow. There's a tremendous bravery, I think, in being able to take that kind of editing from six different editors of the same piece. You know, I mean, one editor would terrify most of us, I think. And maybe you could give us a little example of how a paragraph changes in your own editing process. This is something that Judith has been doing occasionally at bookstores that I think sounds fascinating. I haven't heard it yet, but
Students are always sort of both incredulous and reassured when I tell them how terrible my first drafts are. They're really terrible. They're not just faux terrible. They're truly terrible. In a way, that when you take up the slack, it's usually not much. You don't have to pull something to get rid of all those horrible wrinkles and that sort of mushy language, the positive thinking, you know, the words like great, the adjectives. But you do have to do it, and I sometimes go through 28 drafts of a piece, usually spinning my wheels, though. It's not 28 fresh drafts, it's 28 stale drafts until I find the... And I also never know what I mean to say until I've written a sentence that actually says it. So I thought that I would read some of these first paragraphs, and you'll see what I mean. It was the tofu... Whenever I'm offered a piece that it sounds like fun, I now know that I should run from it and volunteer to write about Wittgenstein and the metaphysicals. And this was a wonderful assignment. It was to go to Japan and to write about the making of artisanal tofu. So I had an incredibly wonderful trip, and my interpreter and friend and a subject, because I was writing about him too, was a great kimono master. And we went to all the tofu restaurants in the temples, and he interpreted for me. And I conceived this sense of great responsibility and reverence for the subject and for the people who were involved in making tofu and for the history of tofu. And that made it harder for me when I came back. I started writing on July the 12th, and I turned in the draft on August the 4th. It was for the food issue had to be in. By the way, towards the end, as I was losing my bearings increasingly, I called someone to be Rolfed. Someone came to the house and Rolfed me.
Does everyone know what that means? Rolfing, that's generational, too.
It's L.A. Yeah. It released something. I sobbed for about 2 hours afterwards. So these were some of the 28 drafts. I usually do not begin drinking at 11 in the morning, but when Yoshimasa Kawashima, a celebrated tofu maker, oinophile, and bon vivant, uncorked a bottle of perfectly chilled 1972 Gevrey Chambertin in the kitchen of his farmhouse on a hillside outside the city of Karatsu on the west coast of Japan, I couldn't say no. I was probably sitting there with a bottle of wine as I wrote that. Then I was sort of going to museums and looking at the extraordinary Japanese watercolors and landscape paintings and the kimonos and all this other stuff. And I love the opening also of 19th century novels that give you the overview of the landscape. You know, this was Thomas Hardy meets Murakami. The rainy season started late in Japan this year. For the first 3 weeks of June, the rice paddies simmered under a milky haze. Housewives, vain of their pallor, went to market wearing hats and gloves or pedaled their bicycle with one hand, the other hoisting a parasol. Many, perhaps most of them, came home with a package of tofu, which in one form or another is a staple of the national diet. So we move from the dream into the merchandising. Still reluctant to give up the geographical, all of this wonderful local color that was in my notebooks, I started this one. Karatsu is a small port city in the Saga Prefecture. The density of the details are staggering. Small port city in the Saga Prefecture on the west coast of Japan, famous for its pottery, a fortified samurai castle from the 17th century that dominates the bay, a spectacularly eroded shoreline furrowed with caves and cliffs, an ancient tract of virgin pines that fringes a fine beach, and a rowdy, picturesque Shinto harvest festival that attracts 500,000 tourists every November. More recently, it has also become known for its zaru dofu, an exquisitely bland and pure form of soybean curd with a meringue-like consistency that is molded in a bamboo basket and served in scoops, a delicacy produced every morning between 1 and 5 a.m. according to a secret recipe devised by a local artisan oinophile, bon vivant, organic farmer, restaurateur, exporter, and man about town, Yoshimasa Kawashima. There were about 14 of those drafts. Then, having exhausted the geographical patience of the subject, I thought, I'm going to change tone, I'm going to get lighter, I'm going to get more modern, get it hipper. This is what I came up with. Writing about tofu, like cooking with it, is a challenge to one's powers of invention, and I was going to introduce a subject somewhat lacking in inherent drama with a story about my ex-mother-in-law, a vagabond of waifish charm who briefly made a living growing wheatgrass in the back of her VW camper and selling its juice with missionary ardor at health food fairs, and who about 30 years ago, concerned that my eating habits and those of her son were poisoning our youth and helping to despoil the planet, gave us a copy of the Book of Tofu, an essential reference work on the history of soybean curd. But having recently spent 3 weeks in Japan living largely on tofu, I lost 5 pounds and feel great, and watching it made with equal measures of reverence, gusto, and virtuosity by elderly fisherwomen, Zen monks, rakish oinophiles, and ninth generation masters of the art, I realized with a guilty pang that tofu is, at least among the unenlightened, the mother-in-law of foodstuffs. Without the slightest twinge of conscience, people feel entitled to make jokes at tofu's expense, rolling their eyes like Rodney Dangerfield while it bobs guilelessly in its tray of cloudy water at the salad bar, or gaily retailing their first encounter at some wacky vegan Thanksgiving in the wilds of Marin County with that tired trope of hippie fundamentalism, the tofu turkey. Well, that was funny for something, but not for this piece. My 6,000-mile journey in all of these extraordinary and reverent tofu makers. But you see, all of this is, I'm revealing myself in these, that sort of the jokey tone, the lush overriding, little hint of dissipation. I had to use the word oinophile 73 times.
I've never heard it pronounced, so I'm really glad I finally learned how to pronounce it.
And it was all a betrayal of the subject. So after the rolfing and the tears and... I don't know how it happens, but suddenly I realized what it was I wanted to say, and this is it. The abbot's garden at the Temple of Daisen Inn in Kyoto is a rectangle of raked gravel bordered by a white wall on one of its long sides and the wooden porch of an old pavilion on the other where the monks meditate. From behind the wall, a camellia bush throws off its scent. The grooves made by the rake run horizontally like steady but freehand rulings on a blank page until they eddy around two conical mounds, each about a foot tall. One evening last June, just after the temple had closed, I joined the sitting meditation, the hour-long zazen, held on the porch and open to the public twice a week. There were 5 other sitters, all Japanese, one a young mother who had her children in tow, 2 plump boys and a little girl. I could hear them squirming at the end of the row, the wood creaks, and once or twice the presiding monk spoke to them in a low voice, breaking the silence. But after a while, with an impressive show of stoicism, they managed to keep still. I had been to Daisen Inn earlier that week, and at my first sight of the stones, I shocked myself by bursting into tears, perhaps because, for all its austerity, the garden is an image of release, of the moment at which, after an intractable struggle, you get permission from yourself to let the inessential go. And that was my struggle with the words and with the subject, and it's what it always is. And when I said that, I freed myself.
Intractable struggle with tofu. Yeah, it's a very beautiful piece, and it had my mouth watering by the end of it, and wondering whether such delicacies can be found in Los Angeles. It sounds like not.
Well, I also couldn't let go of that sentence about guilelessly bobbing at the salad bar. It took me so long to let go of the guilelessly bobbing little thing of tofu. You can get the bobbing tofu here. Yeah. And there may be some wonderful restaurants that even import this stuff from Karatsu.
Yeah, you find out exactly how it's made. It's really fascinating. There's another part of the book that I think is wonderfully revealing about where you come from as a writer some surprising bumps along the way quite early on. And if you would read the part about your mom at the beginning.
Well, my connection to The New Yorker is sort of familial. I mean, like all young writers, I think, in this country, everybody fantasizes about having something accepted at The New Yorker and becoming a New Yorker writer. And I sent my poems in high school, and they were, of course, rejected. My grandfather was a Hungarian baker who emigrated at the end of the last century and went to work for the Fleischmann Company. Ralph Fleischmann was the first publisher of the magazine, and his father built this company, a yeast company, and had famous bakery on East 11th Street, the Vienna Model Bakery. And his father made Ralph Fleischmann apprentice with my grandfather to learn the business of making dough, and they became good friends. And when my mother needed a summer job, my grandfather called his friend Raoul and said, "Fleischmann, do you have something for Alice at your magazine?" And now I know my grandfather never read The New Yorker, or probably even knew the name. And Fleischmann said, "Meisner, I'll find her something on one condition." "What's that?" said my grandfather. "That she's not still so fat," he said. Because Alice was a dreamy girl who ate. She erected a sort of fortress of flesh around herself, and she retreated from the storms of the family. I should preface this by saying, I'll read the beginning of this. "There are many ways for a woman to be lost or to lose herself, and the subject has become one of my specialties. The first of my lost women was my mother, Alice, who was born two blocks from the Yorkville brownstone where I've raised my son. She was generally as unconfiding about herself as a fugitive, which in a way she was, the fugitive from a life that she might have lived." And then I tell the story of The New Yorker. "Alice was the dormouse in a family that loved drama. A Catholic daughter with the same temperament might have dreamed of the convent. Alice put her faith in the efficacy of silent worry on everyone's behalf. She devoured her father's kipful, a Viennese croissant, as voraciously as she read her brother's books, and mutely retreated to the fire escape from household storms. Her younger sister, Charlotte, a tomboy with Titian hair, once bashed Alice over the head with a violin. 'I just got fed up with her goodness,' my aunt told me 70 years later. At 16, however, Alice sloughed her cocoon of flesh and emerged as a shapely girl whose loveliness was both sensuous and fragile. There is something about her enigmatic smile in old photographs behind dark glasses or at the beach in a jersey bathing suit and a striped turban, which suggests that she enjoyed her effect on men. Her decorative stint as a temporary receptionist at the New Yorker's hallowed premises on West 43rd Street led, after she graduated from Hunter, to her employment as a fashion forecaster at Condé Nast. She could never explain exactly what she did beyond spending a fortune on hats and going to the theater and the opera during intermissions, where she made notes on whatever trends in fashion she could discern, which were transferred to color-coded punch cards and analyzed by a mechanical sorting machine at the office. This fantastical interlude, Rube Goldberg meets Dorothy Parker, ended with the Depression when Alice was rather less glamorously employed teaching English and Latin to the rowdy boys in a South Boston high school. By the time I was old enough to take stock of my mother's character, she had reverted to the habits, the furtive eating and daydreaming of her girlhood. Having once been vain of her complexion, she showed a vain indifference to its ravages, which gave her a resemblance to the old Auden. After one of her periodic bouts of starvation dieting, she bought some pretty clothes, and a rich sister-in-law gave her a Dior hand-me-down, which she wore to PTA meetings. But eventually it went the way of her resolve. I knew her mainly as a semi-recluse in a shabby house dress who read with a pencil in one hand and a cigarette in the other. Smoking was probably her greatest indulgence, followed by order, solitude, lists, foul weather, crosswords, and grammar, and the grammarian was a martinet. Alice told me proudly that when Ulysses was first published, she had punctuated Molly Bloom's soliloquy. Until I left for college, my compositions got the same treatment. You have to admit that it reads better this way, she would say, having mutilated some piece of homework with a pair of scissors. The first time that I received a galley, the essay on Nadine Gordimer in this volume, corrected by the late Eleanor Gould, the New Yorker's formidable chief copy editor, it felt as though my maternal nemesis had come back to haunt me. The margins were almost a work of art, every inch finely tattooed with wispy hieroglyphs like the feet of a Moroccan bride. So I took out my mother's old primers, Longman's, Fowler's, Strunk and White, and vowed to make Miss Gould pay Alice, if not me, her most grudging compliment, a clean proof. Alice was over 40 when I was born, and as she needed to become invisible for long stretches, she was fortunate to have produced a placid only daughter who could distract herself. When I was 8, the age that my grandfather escaped from home, I began to write verse. These sing-song ditties, Alice believed, might one day be of interest to posterity. So she recopied them in her schoolmarm's penmanship into a loose-leaf binder. But then she did something I still can't explain. She wrote half a dozen poems of her own and, like a crooked card sharp, shuffled them into the pack. They parroted my diction, but their artful lightness couldn't have been that of a child who blurs out the little that she knows rather than shedding the ballast of too much knowledge to achieve simplicity. Of course they're yours, she insisted when I questioned their provenance. You just forgot about them. She may have thought that by producing a false miracle, she could inspire me to perform a true one, though she was, of course, also showing me up, denying it, confounding our identities, and to the degree that I connived in this perverse act of inverted plagiarism, stoking my grandiosity. Young children may be harder to fool than their parents like to think, but they often don't have the courage of their disbeliefs. Disbelief is essential to good writing, which in my experience is a line-by-line combat with self-forgery. In that respect, it is a humble version of Pascal's bet. Can I or can't I, through a feat of style, prove my existence to intelligent skeptics, none more skeptical than I am? But I also write to discover the nature of my affinity with an elusive subject who is only rarely real to herself. Alice's guises continue to surprise me, and some of them, like a chameleon on a leaf, are hiding in these pages.
It's wonderful. I can't help wondering if you hadn't noticed your mother's poems in that loose leaf, would you have still felt driven to become a writer? I mean, what is your relationship with that strange,
weird,
mysterious, activity of your mother's, that sort of stealth poetry?
I don't know. I've wondered that. I've wondered would I have had the freedom, had my mother not been so merged with me, would I have had the freedom to do something else, and would doing something else have been the right thing? Luckily, you know, it often happens that parents want their children to do something that they want to do, and it ruins everybody's life. But my talent for writing was sufficient so that Alice's daydreams didn't lead me in a fruitless direction. But I don't know. I don't know. She would have, you know, she would have made me somehow wanted. I would have understood that that's what I was supposed to do anyway, whether or not she had written those poems. But the sense of irreality, I think, was heightened by that experience.
Do you did she live to see your great success, your National Book Award?
She did. She lived to. She actually. She died long before Colette was done, but she lived through the Dinnison book. And my mother, who lived in her house dress in Queens and never went anywhere, didn't have a social life, when the premiere of Out of Africa took place in New York, Sidney Pollack very kindly sent a big limousine and an assistant to take my parents to the premiere. And Alice, as much as she would, got dressed up and slicked her hair back with some lacquer. She looked rather like a combination of Auden and Gertrude Stein. And we went to the premiere, and afterwards there was a dinner, and a friend of mine came over and said that she was off to Norman Mailer's house in Brooklyn Heights, but didn't know how she was going to get there. And Alice said, "Oh, darling, take the car."
You call her Alice, so there's a little bit of distance there.
That's I think recent, because I've written about her as Alice. She's become Alice, and her sister Charlotte, who I knew as Archie, who helped me raise my son and who lived with me. It was Alice and Charlotte. They were really the sisters.
Where do you get these incredible subjects? Is it sometimes your editor? Do you pitch your editors? Do you still have to do that?
It's a collaborative process. They propose pieces, and I can say yes or no. I propose pieces. They can say yes or no. Part of the time, most of the problem is that I'm on deadline. I'm sort of on a treadmill, so I don't have time to think of subjects, and I will just grab a ring as I'm going around. Sometimes I have to bail. Not often. Sometimes I realize that when I start something that it's a big mistake. Usually because it's something that I don't like. And I've learned with experience, it's much harder to write an appreciation than it is to write something very negative. And the youthful enthusiasm that one has for savaging something, showing how the vigilanteism of the young critic I've kind of outgrown. So if I feel that I have to write a really negative review, with one or two exceptions, I really enjoyed writing about Catherine Millay, the sexual life of Catherine M. And she wanted a spanking, and she got one.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Do you find yourself surprised along the journey? You once referred in an interview I read online to the decoding process when you're working with the subject of a biography like Colette, that there's a decoding process where you're trying to find the true self of this person. Is that true on the 4,000 word pieces too? I mean, is there a kind of a decoding process?
It's funny that this dichotomy, the dialectic, every life has a dialectic. It's an organizing principle. It's not you can't impose it on every aspect of the life. But I think we all have two poles, and our energy flows between them. And as a biographer, if you can find that, if you can, as a working principle, you have to let it go. But if you can find it, it's really, really helpful. And the true and the false self is one of the dialectics that you find so often in artists' lives. Partly because artists are misfits often, or they're people who are plunked down by accident in a milieu which most of the world of people are not artistic. They're not the aesthetes. They don't look at the world. So artists are often changelings. Too much has been, this has been romanticized a bit too much, but it's nevertheless just a fact of existence that kids grow up in places where people are more into sports and meals and dating and this and that, and what they're interested in is something more cerebral or something more aesthetic. So you develop, as a young person, a false self that meets expectations and that fools people and that copes with your environment and the junior high school locker room and all these other places that you are unavoidably, you find yourself. And only later, when you begin to find your peers in your real world, you realize that this is a false self and you want to get rid of it. And this, the search for the true self for a writer usually is the project of the art.
It certainly explains why biography could be an endlessly fascinating subject. But you've also said that, or I think quoted, somebody said that two biographies, like two marriages, were all one has time for in one's life. Because I'm sure we talk about 7 years, 9 year project. That's just incredible amount of time to devote to a single person, however fascinating. Do you see yourself writing more biographies?
Not a soup to nuts biography. I also think times have changed. I think people want shorter books. I think there's still an audience for the 1,000-word biography, but things are getting faster and faster and more condensed, and people are more and more impatient. And I'm not against condensation. I'm not against the discipline of extracting the essence, the distilled life. I can't do the kind of archival, day-by-day reconstruction of a life. I know I don't have enough time left. So...
But a lot of these essays feel as rich as an entire book, and that's a great tribute to your talent. I want to leave plenty of time for our audience's questions, too, so let me turn it out to you guys. And we have a microphone here, so if you can raise your hand.
Someone always has to break the ice, then everyone else will have a question.
Yes. Thank you for breaking the ice, by the way.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how good I am at it. But anyway, first of all, it's great to see and hear you in person, Gail Akenthal, because I'm a big fan of you. You're a great radio personality.
Thank you.
And I'm also a great fan of Judith Thurman's. I have two or three questions to ask you. One of them just has a yes or no answer. One of the books that I never know how to pronounce her first name. I know I'm supposed to, you're supposed to say Itzhak Denison. Why
you know,
you say Isaac
Denison is fine. She wrote in English. She would have pronounced it Isaac Denison.
Okay.
But you know, we're speaking English. Isaac Denison is fine.
Thank you. That's what I do too. I remember one of the books she read, that she said she always loved going to sleep because her dreams were so wonderful. And I never believed that. And I wondered, and then I have two more questions. Do you believe that? Did you believe that?
I love going to sleep, too.
And are your dreams always wonderful?
No, I don't remember them, so they probably aren't. But no, I'm sure her dreams were not always wonderful. But I do remember that passage, and she quoted an old aunt of hers who died and had inscribed on her tombstone in French, "Le lit est une bonne chose si on y dort, on y repose," which is a very charming thing from a spinster, especially. Bed is a good thing. If you don't sleep there, you repose there. And with all of the connotations that you would sort of add to it, the French has that. I think she was exaggerating, which she did very often.
I also wanted to say, reading about that book, that wonderful book you wrote, was just a stunning piece. If I remember it correctly, I read it a while ago, did you not make the leap, which to me was totally legitimate, from facts to almost a psychological analysis of her? It seemed very legitimate. I'm sure there were people that said, well, it's not just totally factual. She's made some leaps here. Could you talk a little bit about
that? No, I didn't. I don't do that. I speculate. I sort of make associations. I don't depart from fact. I don't like, in fact, biographies in which the writer will invent scenes that didn't happen. I won't do that. I just think that that's fiction. I understand the temptation, but I read her work to extract from it what I thought were truths about the character and about the life. But I hope I didn't make the leap, because
it's very tricky
to make.
Yeah.
Her tales, she wrote more autobiographically in the tales than in Out of Africa. Her autobiography is the fiction. And these tales are marvelously encoded with the truth. And so the trick was to sort of, and she wanted someone to break the code. She was waiting
for
it.
Well, you definitely broke the code, and that's the phrase that Gail used that I thought was appropriate. And my last question, and I'll give it the microphone back, is in the blurb describing your appearance at the library, they said in the blurb that you spent the night once with Jackie Kennedy smoking cigarettes and talking about men. Could you tell us a little bit about what that conversation was like?
Well, it's so poignant now. I mean, it was so poignant. Jackie Onassis, when I was sending around the proposal for Colette, she wanted to publish it. So I went to meet her at her office at Doubleday. And, of course, I got there early. And I was sitting, it was 9 o'clock in the morning, reading, because... And then I didn't notice her. She came quietly up, and she looked down upon me. I looked up, and there's Jackie. There's that face looking down upon you. And from the beginning, this is defined to the character of the great courtesan. She said, "Oh, but you're much prettier than I expected." And we went to her office, and we talked about Colette. And she was most interested in the courtesans of the fin de siècle. She said to me, "They all had women lovers, but you can completely understand it. The very touch of those old toads would have sent me into a woman's arms." So she kept in touch. She wrote me a wonderfully gracious, charming, in that wonderfully flirtatious way that she had, letter when I went to another publisher. She wished me luck. She said, "Oh, you jilted me." And we had dinner. We had a mutual friend named Wendy Gimbel, and she invited the two of us to dinner. And it was a winter night, and Wendy and I were really worried about what we were going to wear. So we thought, well, Jackie, Wendy said, well, Jackie will probably wear trousers and a sweater, so that's what we wore. And we talked about, the three of us had sons. And we talked about men, and she said she always got the best of the White House dinners because Jack sat next to the wives, and she had all of these sort of brilliant men, and he used to complain. And then she said, I'll never forget this, it breaks my heart. She said, if you treat your son right and you let him go, he'll take you to the opera when you're an old woman.
As a follow-up to that excellent question about fact and fiction, which has obviously been in the news a great deal in recent years with regard to writers of both fact and fiction. If I'm not mistaken, your earliest piece on the same, on Dennison, did merge some fiction in there, and you kind of got away with it.
Yeah, it was an innocent, I wasn't trying to fool people. It was a piece written for Ms. in, I don't know, 75. And I did it in the form of an imaginary interview with an old Danish countess. And I did that really to get away from the impossibility of writing about her. And it was the only time in my life that it was easy. I wrote it. It came to me. It just sort of happened. I wrote this piece. I had fun. Unique. 35 years. Only once did this ever happen. And I was channeling the character in the old Danish countess of the woman to whom this book is dedicated, Hayat Matthews, who's the mother of an old friend of mine. A very beautiful and worldly woman who lived in Italy and was sort of had spoke seven languages and who gave me seven Gothic tales for Christmas. She was a sort of godmother. But I was so close to her and the subject, and I got all kinds of details uncannily right about a woman who in fact existed, who had dandy Dinmonts and liked unsugared lemonade. And when Dennison's executor read the piece, she thought that I had really interviewed this woman, and I was sort of poaching on the territory, and she was very alarmed. The magazine didn't say that it was imaginary, that the interview was in fact an imaginary interview. Nobody thought it was necessary.
You didn't appear on Oprah, so it wasn't that big a deal back
then.
Yes,
exactly. Nobody. I was. Okay. No, there were no lawsuits.
Yes. Wait. Need you on mic, yes.
Do you find that the pieces that have taken longer, more difficult to write, tend to be better or worse than the ones that have been slightly less arduous than those?
That's an interesting question. No matter how much time I have, I always sort of diminish it. I always sort of paint myself into a corner so that I sort of wind up with the same amount of time, which isn't very much. Even with the biographies, I think they were all written in 3 months in the end. 7 years of procrastination and 3 months of writing. 7 years of procrastination and 3 months of writing. I'm not sure what makes something better. I don't know. If I knew what made the better pieces better, I would do it every time, so I'm not sure. But I don't think it's a function of time, no. I don't think having more time makes it better or worse. There's a sort of strange connection that happens. It's like in the film business, it's like those old movie lights, those arcs, you have to arc, there's an electric current, and it feels like there's an arc in my brain between feeling and thinking. And I don't know how to make it happen, it just does or doesn't. But I can fake it only up to a point.
Wow. Yes.
I would like to know if, when you interview, do you use a tape recorder? And do you transcribe?
Sometimes I do. And I'm a technological imbecile, as certain members of the audience will tell you. If I have a tape recorder, it is almost sure to malfunction. Also, if you tape things, you have to then transcribe them. And I've learned, I've sort of trained myself to take notes and listen and to take notes. When I'm, it depends on how fast the person talks. That you establish, I often will have a preliminary drink with someone to see how fast they talk. And if I think that I can write, choosing as I go, I will. If I can't, if it's too much, if this is fountain, then I will sort of, my godson will help me. When he lived in New York, he would help me make the tape recorder work. But Vanessa Beecroft I taped. Rei Kawakubo I taped because partly because it was Japanese and it was being translated and I wanted to make sure that the it was already at one remove and I wanted the sound of her voice. I'm doing a piece on Isabel Toledo, the designer, and I went out to dinner with her and her husband, and out of politeness, I didn't take notes. It was the first meeting. I realized I need a tape recorder for them. They're Cuban, and it's just... So it's a mixture. And then I do, of course, transcribe. I do my own transcriptions if I tape something.
Two short questions. Is there anyone you've wanted to profile that you couldn't, and is there someone you still want to profile? And is it a different dynamic? Obviously, it's a different dynamic, but how is it different, a mother having a mother and you being the daughter and you have a son, and how you translate your desires for him as your mother translated hers for you?
You have 3 hours.
Yeah, for the last question.
I'm the mother of a son, too.
I think it was easier for me having a boy. I was very happy, in fact, when the amnio came back male. Because that the danger that I was afraid, really, of the danger of merging and the drama of merging and separation. It's much easier with a boy. It's much cleaner. He still does email me. He's a freshman at college. He emails me for his compositions for sort of once over. But we do this without terrible... He doesn't feel intruded upon, and I don't feel that I'm sort of overstepping my bounds. And so it's much easier with a boy. And I might have been okay with it, but I'll never know. Wait, and the first part of the question was? No, I haven't sort of been deprived of anything. Sometimes I've started on a profile and I've given it up. That was the case with Elfriede Jelinek. I started reading the work and I thought, I can't do this.
Why?
I found it so alienating. Not interesting alienating, just boring alienating.
She was in the newspaper yesterday. Did anyone see that?
No.
She personally defended this Viennese serial killer who passed through society for years, and there's a new biography out about him. I think it was reviewed in the New York Times and LA Times within a couple days of each other. But anyway, she horrifyingly defended him and said he couldn't have done what he in fact did. So,
she didn't believe that he had done it.
She didn't believe that he could be capable of committing murder because he was so charming. And he, as a result, very, very partly because of her defense of him and some other, icons
United.
Of Viennese society, he was let out of prison and killed many more people. Yeah. So, anyway.
Well, yeah, she struck me as somebody who's been living in a cave, one of those Japanese prisoners of war since the 70s, with a hatred of men and this notion of the patriarchy as every man belonging to it. And at the same time, it is and it isn't surprising that a serial killer, a true hater of women, would escape her notice.
Yes, other questions? Yes.
How old was your mom when she died, and what did she die of?
She died at 81, 6 months after my father died, when my son was 3 weeks old. And I'm not sure what she died of. I think she just died of shock that my father had died. She smoked like a fiend, and she was overweight, there was nothing immediate. She just died, and it was... I think she discovered after my father died how indispensable he was. I don't think it had occurred to her. I think she was so shocked that she died.
Yes.
I had a pleasure to hear you at that conference on anxiety and authority and women in New York. And all of a sudden what popped in my head was that the piece by John Laur about stage fright, Frozen, and I wonder, do you have peace in you about anxiety?
Well, that was a wonderful experience for me writing for that conference, and some of it is sort of reprised in the essay on Alice and making her real, because I I was writing about the subject, my subject, anxiety, the anxiety of writing. I'm when it's just talking, I'm never afraid. If it's writing, I'm terrified. It's just, I don't know what that translation, the process of, I'm a ham, you know. I can talk on and on and on. Let me out of my room, and you need a hanger to get me off the stage. But the self-exposure in prose is a different experience. Writing for this conference on the anxiety of creative anxiety, that's when I realized for the first time that I write to make my mother real.
Before we finish, and there are going to be books signed in the next room, so please follow us over there if you are so moved. The title, we neglected the story of the title, Cleopatra's Nose, which has one of those sort of poetic juxtapositions.
I thought of calling the book The Wolf at the Door. Nobody liked that. Then for Edna O'Brien, who's a friend of mine, and she loved the Cleopatra essay, and she said you should call it The Queen Himself. And then my editor said, well, it's going to go in the gay studies section of So then working with Cleopatra, the idea of that being a title piece, I thought Cleopatra's Needle, because I used to walk past in Central Park with my poodle Inky. And then I thought, well, that's pretty banal. And I came to Cleopatra's Nose, but without knowing why it was that I was attracted to it. And I went back to Pascal, and I read the Pensée. And the idea of, had Cleopatra's nose only been shorter, the whole history of the world would have been changed. I loved that. Why? And then I loved the idea that Pascal, this evangelical, missionary, evangelical, terrific prude, died a virgin, who was the greatest connoisseur of vanity and corruption. So I thought it was just an irony that I loved, and we covered the same beat. So,
thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank all of you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET.